Radio Ghana.
Being the news live on Radio Ghana in Accra. Good evening and welcome to the program. My name is Abraham Asari. In tonight's edition of the program, the United Nations celebrates 66th anniversary. Has the organization lived up to expectation, especially in the light of recent happenings? And should trial by jury be abolished? How should one judge's concern be handled? Behind the news, live on Radio Ghana in Accra. Text line for tonight is 026-441-8767. The line again is 026-441-8767. And on the internet at gbcghana.com. Can you imagine the world without the UN? For more than six decades, the international body has been keeping and building world peace, preventing conflicts, promoting social progress, and maintaining global security. Since the formation of the UN, the world has not experienced any warfare on the scale of the Second World War. Today marks exactly 66 years of existence of the UN, and the body was founded to help nations to work together to promote the socio-economic conditions of humanity and to encourage respect for each other's rights and freedoms. So while some analysts have commended the UN for living up to expectation, others think otherwise. As the world marks the birthday of the UN, Behind the News assesses the contribution of the world body in the to the development of humanity. Dr. Vladimir Anchudanso is from the Lagos Center for International Affairs and Diplomacy, and he's on the line now. Good evening to you, Doc. Welcome to Behind the News tonight.
You're very welcome.
66 years of the UN, what does that mean to the international community?
Well, it means a lot, but for the UN, we may have relapsed into another world war, a third world war, or nuclear catastrophe. We may have destroyed the world. So the UN has balanced itself very well. No two ways about that. But on the other hand, of late, especially in the 21st century, the UN is being manipulated by the big powers to their advantage. And that's more scary, scarier than the period when they were balancing themselves. Everybody thought that with the end of the Cold War, the world was going to see a kind of cooperation that we never saw during the Cold War, a kind of global governance where equity is the order of the day. And then we would help all governments, all countries, to develop gradually to the limit where, as Kofi Annan put it, each for each other. You know, when he preached this in the Chicago School, which people call it the Sermon on the Mount. Unfortunately, we are not seeing that multilateralist approach to doing things of late. We're seeing unilateralism. We're seeing might is right kind of things. And that is a little worrisome.
So you made reference to Kofi Annan's speech. He was advocating reforms at the UN. Then Ban Ki-moon came. Do you think that the UN is suffering from some kind of leadership strength at the helm of affairs, leadership problems?
Well, the UN kicks well if you have a very good Secretary General. If you have a weak Secretary General, it is manipulated. So some Secretary Generals are not liked by the big powers. For example, the one before Kofi Annan, Boutros Ghali, the agenda for peace was such that nobody is bigger than the other. Let us all work for peace, because after all, the preamble of the United Nations Charter says we would want to save the future generations from the scourge of war and in greater freedom. So it was more people-centered. But now the UN is becoming more state-centric. And that's very worrisome.
Is that to say that from Boutros Ghali, the UN has suffered some kind of a dip or a decline in its leadership qualities?
I strongly suspect that if we had another Kofi Annan to replace Kofi Annan, we'd have been going places. If we had listened to Kofi Annan and the consensus that we had from the Americas, you know, South America, and we had the Zulwini consensus for Africa, and you know, when Kofi Annan set up the 16-member panel to look at how best we can change the UN in structure so that they could help in the development of the world rather than the belligerents. And that was very, very ingenious in the sense that he had seen the end of the Cold War. What else do we do? Let's come together and build the world. Socio-economic development rather than building up arms and things. Whom are we fighting? But we didn't listen to him. We were just rather against him, and especially the big powers. Made it clear that they weren't going to listen to him, especially when he made it clear that the war on Iraq in 2003 was illegal, and really illegal, because the UN didn't authorize it, you know. And that was the scary moment for the UN. It nearly disintegrated because some of the Western powers also did not support it. And the UN was left hanging very seriously until quite recently when it came together again. Now, as they have been able to come together, some big core powers are still manipulating it. They draw up the proposal for sanctions, and they say, we'll lead that sanction, that kind of thing. They coerce people to vote for such sanctions and whatever it is. And then come to think of the latest one we have on hand. I mean, it's scary these days.
So what is Ban Ki-moon not doing right?
What he's not doing right is pandering to the whims of the big powers. I mean, it's like when you see his speech at... clearly, he's not the Kofi Annan type, you know. I mean, he was even at the forefront of the war on Libya, you know, his speeches. I didn't like it at all.
You think Kofi Annan would have condemned the war in Libya?
Iraq? Excuse me?
You think Kofi Annan would have condemned the invasion of Iraq, of Libya?
No, if Kofi Annan wouldn't condemn it at all, because what the resolution 1973 was supported by a lot. To make sure that what is happening in Syria did not happen in Libya. That is understandable. We all accept it. But then it didn't have an element of regime change and killing of innocent people, the destruction of Libya. How many cities have been destroyed? I mean, who is going to rebuild that? I don't think Kofi Annan would have supported that. Kofi Annan was able to delay the invasion of Iraq, for example. He went to Iraq himself to go and talk to Saddam Hussein, persuade him to listen, to avoid whatever it is. Then the war, and Kofi Annan said, look, we haven't authorized you. Has Ban Ki-moon said anything? You know, this is my personal worry, that the UN is now being used to satisfy the, you know, sort of whims of some big powers. That's scary.
But the UN should be able to call its members to order if it found out that Gaddafi was not behaving well. It was necessary, and that's why the resolution 1973 was passed.
No, I'm not against that. You know, the resolution 1973 is to make sure that those people being called rats and being killed left and right would stop that. And there are several ways of doing that, instead of destroying Libya. Libya has been completely destroyed. And that is I'm not crying for Gaddafi. I'm crying for Libya and Libyans. I'm crying for all the economic achievements that have been destroyed overnight, and that Libyans are going to suffer the more because of one man. The UN could have done better. And I'm saying, after the Cold War, can't we work out some modalities for bringing peace to such countries where we have dictators and where we have problems like this? Is it always the case that NATO, because of their firing power, should do what they did? That is the problem for the UN to answer.
How about the UN Security Council? Is it necessary at all to have a Security Council that is, you know, occupied by people who have the power of veto?
At the 50th anniversary of the Security Council, there were several intellectuals who wrote a lot about the need for changing the composition of the Security Council. That debate went on until Kofi Annan wanted to do the changes quite recently. And that debate was this. The structure that was put in place in 1945 has outlived its usefulness. In fact, that structure was necessary at the time. Those days, it was so much state-centric in the sense that it is state-to-state. These days, we have non-state actors, you know, playing a big role in the global governance or global architecture. What do you do with them? In fact, the UN Charter has no room, for example, for peacekeeping. There's nothing like peacekeeping in the UN Charter. So you see, people call it Chapter 6 and a half. Why do they call it that? Because between Chapter 6 and Chapter 7, there is nothing to say that the UN should use mercenaries. I call them mercenaries. You use those peacekeepers to go and stop some war somewhere. So the UN has been able to force itself one way or the other to manipulate or to navigate the murky waters of the Cold War. Is the structure now necessary? This is what everybody is asking. So I think this is the time to reorganize the UN. UN as an institution is a very good institution.
But who does the reorganization, Dr. Nfidanso? Who does that reorganization? If we're talking about weak leadership, who does the reorganization then?
The reorganization must come from it's a member-driven institution. It's a member-driven. I mean, we have an organization where five basic powers control the whole world, and the UN General Assembly, where it is more democratic, does not rule the world. So, I'm calling for it. But unfortunately, Article 108 of the UN Charter allows for, or calls for, something like that. When the UN was set up, it said after 10 years of implementation of this charter, let the assembly think of ways of amending it if possible. Since then, the people have not allowed it. Because the interpretation is that even if you want to amend it, come back to us for us to approve it. I mean, it's sad.
Membership-driven organization, 190 countries from 51 at the time of its formation, being controlled by about five countries. Is this a democratic organization?
That is exactly why people are calling for reorganization. Recraft the architecture of the UN. That's all. And that's what Kofi Annan started. Can we concentrate on socio-economic things? Can we concentrate on people? Can we make sure that when somebody is in America and he's so satisfied and he's throwing something away, somebody in Ethiopia is also satisfied? I mean, these were the things that Kofi Annan was saying. Strictly speaking, this is what he was calling for. And he was saying, can we change the structure in such a way that we can achieve what I'm saying? And it was not allowed.
But so would that ever be done?
Again?
Can the UN ever be reformed?
If the 192 members, countries we have in the world, you say with one go, instead of coalitions, instead of alliances, we say we have transatlantic alliance, Europe and America. If we stop these alliances, if all the members of the UN would come with one go against the five and their interests, I think we can do it. It must be a collective effort. But what is happening is that there is a divide and rule kind of thing, that the big powers always have some people to their side, including Africans. You know, all of a sudden, the resolution against Saddam Hussein showed that some African members of the Security Council were important, Cameroon and others. It's the same thing with Libya. Then you become so important. Then they either, I use the word bribe, because all of a sudden, several things are given to the country, and you have to vote in a certain way. It's really sad. But if we all would think about the future of the world, then we need to restructure and democratize the UN to the extent that we will look for socioeconomic development throughout the world.
What can regional blocs do, like the Africa Union? This is a union on whose, you know, home soil the Western powers have come to, you know, aid the elimination of one of their own, Gaddafi.
You said which the powers have come to eliminate their own?
Yeah, I mean to aid or to help, you know, the rebels, of course, to eliminate Gaddafi. And this is a continental body. We have, I mean, I'm talking about the Africa Union.
How united are they? Who were the people? Qatar. Look, you must understand the matrix of that organization, the Islamic organization. You must also understand the geopolitics of the area. There is a Sunni majority in Saudi Arabia, which Americans support. Because of that, they supported a Sunni minority in Iraq. They supported Saddam Hussein in order that they would go against the Shiite majority of Iran. And they fought a senseless 8-year war. All right? Only for Saddam Hussein to know that, well, Americans like me, let me annex Kuwait. That is when they saw that if he's able to annex Kuwait and become the regional power, they may attack our friend. That is what? Saudi Arabia. So now they have to balance the equation. Get Saddam Hussein out.
I was actually speaking. The question actually is about the Africa Union and how it can make its voice, you know, heard or can influence UN decisions. And I'm referring to the fact that on its own soil, I mean the African soil, where we have an African Union, it allowed the Western powers, NATO, to aid the elimination of one of their own leaders, Saddam Hussein. Isn't it a pity?
It's a pity. It's a very sad situation. It's very sad that Africa is leaderless. There are no pushers, like in Europe, France and Germany are the strong pushers. When Bush was going to Iraq and France was strongly against it, and Germany was strongly against it, the Transatlantic Alliance was hiccuping. Africa, we don't have pushers who say yes and no. People line up behind the big powers. So Nigeria says, I don't support. Nigeria says, I support. South Africa says, I support. You know, that kind of thing. South Africa says, no, hey, come on, I don't support the NTC. Nigeria says, no, we have to support. Ghana has right to support. So we are divided. We don't have a leader. We don't have a pusher. That's one. Two, weak economy. Our economies are weak, and so we're ready to lick whatever is falling off from the big powers. And thirdly, we don't have trade leadership in the various countries of Africa. If you have them, trade leaders, those who really want to build their countries and build Africa, you not stomach this nonsense. No matter how weak and poor we are, we'll be proud enough to be able to say, this is an African problem. We know how to solve it. We will try and see what we can do. And then give us your support by our way and not by your way. Now, it's like they have done it and say, Africa, give us your support.
I gather from what you are saying then that there is no leadership, any good leadership, I must say, anywhere in the world, because even the UN has its own leadership problems. I'm not sure that African Union should be blamed.
No, I wouldn't say so. I wouldn't say so. The fact that somebody is not correct doesn't mean that you also don't have to be correct. I mean, can't we see what is happening? If throughout the world there is a problem, then we say we don't have a problem. The UN problem, of course, are some of them are African problems. How to get a standing army, how to get, how to be able to structure it, how member states should be able to throw one line and things like that. It's difficult, we agree. But if you look at Europe, I mean, membership is very strong because of conditionalities. And if you are inside, you behave in a certain way. Your economy must be in a certain way. If you are falling out, there is a bailout and things like that. But Africa, everybody is doing whatever he likes. Or, and always we end up with a problem. So the international community comes, and they come with their interest. If it is Cote d'Ivoire or Libya or whatever, they come with a certain interest. Why was there so much interest against Mugabe, for example? You know, I do not like Mugabe, but I don't like the way he was treated. You know, I don't like Gaddafi. I personally am Kidan, so I don't like Gaddafi and his style, because he didn't build a system. He held the country so much to the hills. GDP is very high. But the system was Gaddafi, and the Gaddafi was the system. That's not how to do it. But is that the way to treat him if we don't like him? So these are some of the questions we keep asking.
Dr. Angela, so I'll come back to you briefly before I let you go. Mr. Kwesi Pratt, who is a seasoned journalist and managing editor of the Insight newspaper, is on the line. Good evening to you, Mr. Pratt. Welcome to Radio Ghana tonight. Today is UN Day. When it was set up, it was to develop friendly relations among nations, to promote social progress and to harmonize actions of nations. You know, would you say that 66 years after its formation, the UN is achieving these goals and it's doing them very well?
Well, the primary role of the United Nations organization was to prevent the outbreak of a world war and to promote harmonious relations between countries in order to avoid strife and so on. Unfortunately, the UN has become an instrument in the hands of the major powers for the promotion of war. The UN no longer represents the interests of the underprivileged in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. The UN is being used or manipulated to achieve the aims of the United States especially and its allies. And unfortunately, China and Russia are not able to hold the US in check. I think that by and large, the UN is not serving the purposes for which it was established.
Why are China and Russia unable to do this? Because China, for instance, the second biggest economy currently in the world, it has overtaken Japan. It has some power.
That is the strange thing about China. China is not just the biggest economy. China has a quarter of the world's population. So to all intents and purposes, China ought to be the superpower of the world. Unfortunately, the Chinese authorities have allowed the U.S. to dictate the pace in the United Nations and to dictate the pace throughout the world. I was very, very surprised when the Chinese allowed NATO forces to hide under the cover of the UN to perpetrate serious crimes in Libya. I was surprised when the Chinese allowed the UN to be used as an umbrella to subvert the interests of the people of La Côte d'Ivoire and so on, you know. So the UN is not playing the role it's supposed to play.
Why are the underprivileged, you know, Africa, for instance, they don't seem to be concerned?
Part of it happens to be the problem with our own leadership. Apart from President Robert Mugabe of Zimbabwe, none of the African leaders who addressed the United Nations insisted on a permanent seat on the Security Council for Africa. Africa is by far, in terms of resources, much, much bigger than the United States of America. Africa, in terms of population, is much bigger than the United States of America. So why is Africa not having a voice on the UN Security Council? And our leaders are not pushing strong enough, you know, for a permanent seat for Africa on the UN Security Council. But the other problem, of course, has to do with the fact that many of our leaders, before they go to the UN, go to the US for direction on how to vote, on what positions to take, and so on. That's a huge problem for the African people.
But do we need a Security Council? Why don't you scrap it and have this a General Assembly?
Well, that's an option which is better than the current arrangement. To have member states, you know, vote on the basis of simple majority in order to make decisions. Look, if you take, for example, the blockade that the U.S. has imposed on Cuba, in the General Assembly, indeed, most of the time, only 2 to 4 countries vote against the resolution. And yet, nothing happened. The United States continued to impose this crippling blockade on Cuba. You understand? So it's like the United States and other nations are not answerable to the UN. They don't abide by resolutions of the United Nations. They do as they please. Look at the Palestinian case. The vast majority of member states vote for a separate state for Palestine. In fact, they vote against the building of settlements of Palestinian lands and so on. Israel doesn't give a hoot. Israel is supported by the United States to violate United Nations resolutions with impunity and so on. You know, so the UN has lost its bite. The UN is becoming more and more irrelevant as a tool for liberation, as a tool for upholding international justice and so on. The UN is becoming a tool in the hands of the United States for establishing its hegemony and maintaining that hegemony.
Is there a danger in that? Because as you said, if the UN was formed to prevent world wars and wars do not just break out, you know, is there a danger that we could go back to 1939-45? A world war again because of
the world is certainly becoming lawless. You know, if the bigger nations are not going to obey the law, if the stronger nations are not going to respect the will of the people and so on, then of course you're going to have what you call extra forum activities, extra forum inspired, you know, activities. And there's going to be a lot of lawlessness and anarchy across the world. If the United States will not obey the law, why would people in Somalia obey the law? Why would people in Gambia obey the law if the United States will not obey the law? So we are leading more and more to a general state of lawlessness across the globe, a general state of anarchy across the globe.
In the case of Africa, you know, apart from just addressing the UN General Assembly, where Mugabe maybe was the only most vocal or, you know, who could speak on world matters, is there no other way that a body like the African Union and other regional blocs could stand up and speak their voice and make sure that reforms are enforced in at the UN?
Well, the African Union is becoming rather impotent. If you look at the Libyan crisis, the position of the African Union was that it should be resolved through political means, through negotiation. So, and yet that was ignored by NATO. That was ignored by the United States of America. The Africans just sat back and allowed NATO forces to go into Libya to kill hundreds of thousands of civilians, to destroy the important cities of Libya, and now they are talking about sharing their oil resources. And Africa is just sitting there impotent, not raising a finger. So the quality of our leaders in Africa is a major problem. And the fact that we are not working in concert is another major problem.
Is it not because you do not have the military power? This is a military, you know, language you should be speaking. You don't just speak. You don't have the wherewithal.
Well, military power itself comes with political cohesion. If there's no political cohesion, how do you build a cohesive, you know, organized, regular military force? It's impossible. The first problem that Africa needs to resolve is the political problem. And this is the position which was taken by people like Nkrumah and Sekuturi and so on. It's important to address the political problem first.
In your mind, what do you think the way forward should be for the UN? I'm sure that there are some positives.
Well, the way forward is that all of us need to speak out and speak out loudly. We need to compel our leaders to protect our interests. We need to compel our leaders in Africa to work together. And we need to exert sufficient pressure through all international fora to ensure that the UN becomes a democratic organization. If the UN is not going to become a democratic organization and is just going to remain a stick in the hand of the United States of America and its allies to bully the rest of the world, then our membership of the UN is completely useless and of no value to us.
We thank you very much for talking to us tonight, Mr. Pratt. Have a good night.
Thank you, sir.
Dr. Angie Enchidansu, if I can also ask you, what do you think the way forward should be for the UN?
Well, basically, I do not think I subscribe to the idea that the UN should be thrown away. You don't throw the dirty water.
Well, that is if current events continue, if the trend continues as it is, it
you
may become
cannot.
Useless.
You still cannot. You still cannot. All you have to do is to make sure that these negatives are minimized and then eliminated. That's the best. Because if you look at the other side, the UN is doing so well for several countries.
But there doesn't seem to be hope from what the discussions we've had so far. From what you yourself have said, do you think there is hope for any change, real change we're talking about?
There is hope for real change. And I think I want to correct an impression. It wasn't true that it was only Mugabe who was championing a change of the Security Council. In fact, Africa went there with the Israeli consensus, in which they were asking for two things. Either you scrape it off, that is the veto power, or when you are not going to scrape it off, then enlarge the membership and give the veto power to all the regions. Africa would have two places. So Africa also asked for such a situation for the reorganization. And these are some of the things that we need to be doing to change the structure of the UN. Because what we need is a new international architecture. No country can live in isolation or as an island. We would have more unilateral actions if the UN were not there. America could just go anywhere and do whatever it like more if there's no UN than if it is like this, and then we try to help change it.
But they're still having their way. They're having their way. They went to Iraq without the UN mandate.
If you have a bully, he will have his way. We are not lobbying. You were talking about Russia and China. They reneged on their promises, and they didn't vote for the resolution. But before the war ended, they were recognizing the NTC, and they were going there. In fact, envoys went there to go and negotiate a new relationship with the new incoming government. That's worrisome. If Africa were lobbying, just like the Chinese would lobby us when they need us, we are not lobbying because of the leadership problems that I've spoken about. If we lobby, we'll get many more people standing against America. If we're lobbying seriously, we'll get even Western powers to be on our side. Look at what is happening now. The Occupy Wall Street movement is all over the place now throughout the world. As far as Melbourne in Australia, as Japan, you know, Tokyo. So it shows that something is wrong with this kind of governance that we have in the West, you know, system. And Africa is talking on the same language that, hey, look, we are also suffering. So we must have a world body that is more interested in our socioeconomic development than a world body that is interested in bullying. And you can't just throw the body away because it's not there. That is anarchical. And I believe we need to gradually throw away the negatives of the UN rather than throw the whole UN away.
So is there anything to celebrate today, being its 66th birthday? Is there anything to jubilate about
surely,
the UN?
Surely, even the Devil's Day is celebrated. I strongly suspect that.
When is that? I never knew the devil had a day.
Come again?
I never knew the devil had a day.
No, the point is that you celebrate the Devil's Day at least to bring to fore what the devil stands for. So it is part of the thing is what you and I are doing right now. The celebration, we talk about it, we are able to see what is wrong, and then we begin to work towards change. So I believe that the celebration of UN Day is not very important. At least it tells us the history of it, and we begin to analyze where we're coming from, where we are now, where we should be going.
Well, thank you so much, sir. Have a good night. Thanks so much for talking to us tonight. Dr. Vladimir Nchidanso of the Lagos Center for International Affairs and Diplomacy. Well, let's also talk now about UN policies. We have Dr. William Haji, who is a policy analyst. Dr. Haji, good evening to you. Welcome to Radio Ghana. Let's look at the perspective of policy from the UN or at the UN. Do you think that in that direction, it's been able to achieve any objective?
Well, definitely. The UN has served many countries during the post-war years, and is still doing that in terms of defining development agenda. We would, if we took our minds back, we'll realize that the UN in the early 80s and into the mid 80s began this whole issue about poverty reduction. It moved away from the traditional approach to just pure fiscal monetary policies that were being pursued by other institutions into more social development related issues. And that has worked over the period. You know, currently, many countries around the world are working towards achieving the Millennium Development Goals, which are basic policies that countries that are signing into these particular goals are expected to give to their people. So, yes, there's some policy relevance in the work of the UN, and that is still valid up to
today. So what do you think the policy direction will be from the UN side? You know, what prescription are they going to give? Are they likely to give to Libya, for instance?
The situation in Libya represents virtually a devastation of a lot of the development efforts that have been made. And so there's a need for redefining which direction Libya is going to go using whatever resources are available for now. For instance, basic issues around people's rights. The violation of people's rights occurred extensively under the Gaddafi regime. People lost their ability to freely speak. So I believe that the UN's role in that regard will be to set the agenda for the accession of rights as they relate to access to services, access to goods, basic social and economic rights must be secured. And clearly...
And basic human rights, I believe. Basic human rights also.
Basic human rights as well.
Yeah,
as I said, they've been violated quite extensively.
But even people are talking about the way Gaddafi himself was killed. And, you know, I read what the UN General Secretary General said. He didn't talk about his rights being violated. He rather said that marked the beginning of the rebuilding of Libya. Is that not problematic?
Well, they are very different interpretations of how he was killed, and people get rather sentimental about it. I personally don't think that it was appropriate to take him down that way. But in the heat of all of that, and given the anguish that people have felt because they've been denied rights, or some of them have actually suffered some form of torture, or their relations have died in the process, mob justice was visited on him right there on the spot. It doesn't make it right, though. I mean, I think that they've lost an opportunity to understand his approach to doing things. They've lost an opportunity to actually bring him to justice. But having said all of that, I think that the Libyan people are the best judges of what they've gone through. And sometimes if you take people to the brink, the reaction, the response to, you know, the call for change can be very drastic. And that's exactly what happened in Libya.
But in the case of Iraq, even though the UN did not sanction the war there, as a member country, you think that the UN was, you know, at the forefront of its rebuilding?
As my colleague said, Dr. Enchidanso said, that some of these superpowers assume, you know, some...
Bully tactics.
Yeah, bullying tactics that undermine the relevance of the institution. Without the UN, I mean, the policeman's responsibilities would have been virtually, you know, delivered in ways that will make, you know, other countries feel that, well, if anybody else can do it, then we can do it and bring chaos around the world. And so that approach is inappropriate, and everybody knows that it was wrong for the U.S. and the allies to invade Iraq without the appropriate U.N. sanctions. And I think that with time it's become evident that that was a wrong approach. They would not allow anybody to do that. That's why they sought Resolution 1973 to get into Libya, because if you did that, then you're undermining the authority of the U.N. to at least moderate the international politics.
Just before I let you go, Dr. Raji, you know, issues of trade imbalance and unfavorable trade terms are the challenges that we, you know, on this side of the globe normally complain about. The UN doesn't seem to be effective in ensuring fairness in these areas.
I think the UN has tried. If you recall, they started with the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade and moved to UNCTAD, and is moved all the way to what we have now. We're all signing into the new World Trade Order. And yes, that needs to be done. But as we know, we as part of the developing countries, we are very weak in terms of our negotiation rights in the WTO agreements. And so we still need to develop the capacity to negotiate, because we are not competitive in our local market, neither are we competitive in the international market, purely because we sign into agreements that take away our ability to actually export into the market They've raised several barriers that prevent us from entering to those markets. So I think the relevance of the UN in this regard will be to insist that countries are given the opportunity to be virtually competitive in markets within their own jurisdiction and outside.
Now, I'm sorry, I have to ask you another question before I let you go. In countries where there is violence, it's mostly those who are poor who engage in violent acts because sometimes the basic needs of life are not there. Is the UN able to balance the equation?
Well, first of all, let me contest the point that it's those who are poor who tend to visit violence. Violence can erupt from any angle, especially sometimes, people trade in guns. People profit from violence. So there are people who instigate violence. They may be very wealthy people because that's their business. But I think that the UN has a role in trying to promote peace around the world and indeed promote all those policies that would ensure that poverty is minimized and that those who perpetrate violence are punished. That way, at least we can minimize the eruption of violence in various communities.
Dr. Haji, we thank you very much for talking to us tonight and have a good night, sir. Dr. William Haji is a policy analyst. You're listening to Behind the News live on Radio Ghana in Accra. If you happen to be at Heiligendamm on the eastern coast of Germany, gbcghana.com is where you can get us. Yeah, just a few of your text messages. This one from Bantamville Ground Zero Ridge. African leaders are just like junior school prefects. The AU has lost its value and needs to be dissolved. It came from Raymond Bantabil. While in Tamale, UN is nothing but a tool used to advance the agenda of the West, Africa deserves better from the Westerners. Bakuwali, Atsola, and to African leaders, respect their democratic principles to step out of power by the will of their sovereign people and strongly unite as an African state. America will always use as against our loved and cherished leaders. You're listening to Behind the News live on Radio Ghana in Accra. Well, the trial jury is a system that has been used in many countries over a long period. Its effectiveness, however, depends on the level of understanding of the legal issues surrounding a case. The role played by a jury is a dicey one, since a mistake they commit can go against an accused person in a criminal trial. But just like any human institution, mistakes do occur in trial by jury. Is it time to review or even do away with this system? A High Court judge is strongly recommending to Parliament to abolish trial by jury. He believes that his hands were tied on two occasions to go along with the jury who showed little knowledge about an issue at stake. So what is involved in a trial by jury and what are the pros and cons in that system? Afed Agbashi is the MP for Ashaman and chairman of the Parliamentary Committee on the Judiciary. Mr. Agbashi, good evening. Welcome to Radio Ghana. First of all, have you ever observed a trial by jury? Good evening, Mr. Agbashi. Can you hear me? I'm afraid we do not seem to have Mr. Agbashi, Afed Agbashi, MP for Ashaman on the line. We are trying to get him so that we can talk on this issue of trial by jury. You're listening to Behind the News. The program is live in Accra and across the country on all GBC networks. This one, Baba Musa and UDS says that it's a text message. The UN is a hypocritical organization and therefore African leaders must break away from it because it has no interest in Africa. The UN and AU should be ashamed of themselves about Libya. Chonla at Kumdi, he sent us that. Behind the News, live on Radio Ghana in Accra, there is a text message that says, Ban Ki-moon is a total failure, but Gaddafi is a hero and a true African. May his soul rest in perfect peace. And this one came from Osman East Mampusi. Behind the News, live on Radio Ghana in Accra, we'll come back to the trial by jury story after this one. Well, the debate about ex-gratia and resettlements of past presidents of Ghana will not go away easily. On many occasions, the debate has been influenced by the allegiance of those engaged in it. Recently, the issue has been reignited by the houses made available to Ghana's two former presidents. With reports of rejection by the former presidents, there's another suggestion that instead of putting up buildings, the state should rather pay the rent of houses acquired by the former leaders. For some, the debate should not just be property, but the building of institutions and recognition of the role of the leaders. Further, there is the claim that it aids in establishing the relatively young democracy. So how is this possible? Paul Abraham Pemensa is a program office debate about ex-gratia and resettlement for former presidents.
Yeah, good evening, my brother, and good evening to our listeners. I think it's a laudable idea and a suggestion that has been put forward by our president for consideration. Let's make it clear, it's not an imposition. It's he's just waging into the debate that has been going on for quite some time now. When we put forward the Constitutional Review Committee or Commission to go into some aspects of the Constitution that we think need to be revised. Yes, when we asked the view of CDD Ghana, we did something on presidential emolument in general, and we feel that some aspects that need modification, one of which was a resettlement of former president. Our argument on the structure, the building, was that anytime, always when it comes up, it brings controversies. Just recently, President Kufuor has rejected a case to the one that was providing him the possibility to be situated at Trasaco Valley. What it means that perpetually and time to come, we're going to have these arguments. Therefore, as the president has suggested, actually it's a suggestion that in Ghana here, looking back at presidents who have come to power, almost all of them have their premises before they come to power. Why don't we continuously maintain them while they stay in their own premises?
It's possible to have a president in future who may not have his own facility, a housing facility, before he becomes president.
Wherever he's occupying, he can continuously occupy that, and we maintain him, we pay for security, we pay for transportation, we pay for...
He may have rented that facility, and I'm sure the landlord may also be in need of his house.
I've come forward. Let's put it this way. In our manifestos, in the eager for president, people to come become president, they claim to become and rescue people, the poor, the downtrodden, people who might not even have a single meal during the day. And therefore, I don't think the ego, the motive has been to acquire wealth. But because it's constitutional, it's something that we are mandated to provide. But if as a nation we feel something that needs revision, I think I support that revision.
Why don't you say that to prove that we have the capacity to lead a country like Ghana, you should be one who's been able to at least put up a house?
Then we are also going to deprive people, as you said. People might also put the argument that then we are becoming elitist, too elitist, too capitalist, that we are giving priority to people who are wealthy. That's contrary. They become mandated on that way. So that will bring so many arguments surrounding our qualifications as to one who should become president. But of course, yes, as I said, as implied, most of the people who occupy or buy for that position, looking at the finances involved, even going around the country itself, needs somebody who must have acquired some status or some money before he can do that. But it's people just hide the facts. I mean, nobody in the country can become a president, can go through this habit of campaigning, purchasing of cars, vehicles for that, even fueling, and to write to even one region. If you don't have the money, you cannot do that. So it implies that people who vie for such positions are people who are already rich, who already made their status. For example, President Kufuor is supposed to be provided for a house. Throughout his years as president, he was occupying his own private house. Why can't we do that, continuously maintain him, provide the security, the utility, all those things that he would need to be there? I mean, what is important is to give him some place to work, office.
We have best farmer. Anytime a best farmer is always given a house, a best teacher has a house. Why can't a president who served 4 or 8 years be entitled to a house?
The best farmer is not constitutional. It's something that some corporate institutions put together. If we want it to be that way, then it cannot be that whether we have the funds or not, we must do it.
It may not be constitutional, but the state facilitates that.
So that's what I'm saying. The state facilitates, and sometimes you see the kind of support we get from corporate bodies. Yeah, so it could be that. That, well, the president is going to be maintained through his own facilities by paying rent to him, utility services. But if any corporate institution so wishes to do that, as it was reported that Reggie Manuel has provided some security facility for the president, so be it. But of course, it's a suggestion that it needs revision. And don't forget, you see, any time these things come up, I think it's better we have this revision and have a standard that we're going to use so that at the end of the tenure of every presidency, we're not going to have this temporary committee that seeks to bring up this suggestion so that it becomes a permanent thing. For instance, if a president goes off, we give him a certain percentage of his personal salary. So it becomes something standard that no president will have the chance to review it. That would suggest that it's being a witch hunt, it's being marginalized, being also. So I think the revision is in totality good. Whether we continuously provide for buildings or not, there should be a standard that is set there permanently, and that will not need ad hoc committees to be going into them.
A former president definitely would deserve something, you know, worth his status. I'm sure that the rent advance that to be paid could be enough to purchase him a home or a house. Sorry.
Well, it's a suggestion that should come forward. I mean, it's a whole lot of things that people have put forward. DD has written. I think IDEC has put in some suggestion. So many people have written about that. What is important is that to us, as important as for CDD, there should be a permanent structure of standards that should measure awards and benefits for former presidents and all other people who should go into that. The era of having a temporary committee to institute measures as to how much and what should be given to particular people, that's what should be avoidable.
Nope.
But I think presidents come to help the poor, and they don't come to acquire so much wealth. So if you're as a president, you have your house, 1, 2, 3 houses. What do you need a fourth house for? I think all these things should be looked into.
But what should we do, or what can we do as a people to streamline this kind of excretia matters, this back and forth debate and rejections and denials and all that offers that are not accepted? You know, what should we do to have a streamlined way of settling our former public officials?
Thank you very much. Let me give you an example. I once worked for a bank, and the scandal they had at the bank was that it was measured at the price of a crate of minerals. That at any particular point in time, if somebody retires and he's going home, we give him 10 crates worth of minerals for his departure this thing, and we give him 10 times the salary that he's earning now to buy some plots or some other things. So we can have a standard set for president that at the time that you're leaving, you're going to give you 10 times your salary as retirement benefit for your accommodation, for your everything, for your vehicle, for everything. So when that standard is set, then it doesn't require to put in place an interim committee to look into that, or a president should propose for parliament to approve while the president also signs for parliament. Then it becomes something that we can connive and do. So there should be a standard set, whether paid against one salary at a particular time, or paid against a certain measurable standard that in financial terms, that is in existence.
Those who argue that, you know, our former presidents do not really deserve to be given a home because they're also public servants. I mean, not just a home, but they argue against the kind of packages that are given them. Are they right to do that? Do you think that they have a case?
Well, as you rightly said, on one hand, we argue that being a first man of the land, he has been a president who has served the whole nation. They deserve to be settled well and comfortably. On the other hand, there's an argument also goes that looking at the status and the standard of the country, the poverty level, the number of people who cannot even make ends meet, the number of school structures that are not completed, the number of students who go to school under trees, it behoves on us as a nation to cut down the kind of standard we set for certain group of people. And of course, in our poverty reduction strategy, in another document, we talk of bridging the gap between the top and the down. So I think these are some of the arguments that we should look into. Let's cut our code according to our size. If we are setting the president, that's fine. But it shouldn't be so wide for the downtrodden that will also encourage people to also become so angry and ginger armed robbers and other things. You know, when you look into the theories of distribution of wealth, People even talk of armed robbery as a kind of redistribution of wealth. And it comes about as because of wider margins of wealth that exist in the country. So all these arguments should also be looked into.
But I'm sure you agree with me that for democracy to thrive, we need to spend money. Democracy is not cheap, is it?
It's very expensive, and democracy also says that equality before the law and equal opportunity for everybody.
That is to say that the president should be equal to somebody who is, I mean, I don't want to use certain words, but should be equal to me or to you?
Yes, but the margin should not be that wide. That's the point I'm driving home. Yes, the president needs to be subtle and subtle. The people in the country must also meet some standards. Therefore, the margin, that's why I said we cut our code.
How do you determine that margin? You mean the president or a former president and somebody like you or me, the gap between us should not be too much. Is that what you're saying?
The gap between, you know, we talk of equality before the law. The president is a president. He needs some comfort. That's what I said. The argument is there. He needs some comfort. Yes, he's retired. He served the nation. All right. He needs some comfort. But that comfort must also be measured according to the worth of the nation, the standard of living in the country.
I must thank you so much for tonight, for talking to us tonight. Paul Abraham Famensa, Programs Officer with CDD Ghana. It's always wonderful talking to you. Have a good
thank
night,
you,
my brother.
You too.
Behind the News, live on Radio Ghana in Accra. We are also live on all our regional FM stations across the country and on the internet at gbcghana.com. We must apologize for our inability to bring you this story on the trial by a jury, which is reported, where a judge, Justice Kosi Kagu, is reported to have said that this system should be abolished, you know, because at a point he had his hands tied because the jury didn't seem to have good knowledge of the case on hand, and so they decided on something that he didn't agree with. But we couldn't do it tonight because we had some challenges getting to our guests who had agreed to speak to us. The telephone lines gave us some challenges, and so we'll try and see whether we can treat that story tomorrow. You're listening to Behind the News. This is live on Radio Ghana. Here are some of your text messages. This one says, Abraham, indeed, the celebration of UN Day is totally useless. UN allowed the so-called NATO to invade Libya and killed innocent people. AU Farouk sent us that. Here are some other text messages. Raymond Akati from Kwetwe says, doctors should not use the nature of your job to collapse the economy. Raymond Bantabil, after Boutros Ghali, the UN has produced weak leaders, including our own Kofi Annan. Gaddafi, may your soul rest in perfect peace. However, Africans should know we have lost a great man. And this one came from Karim Bana at Sabari. David Kunkumada, the fact that the AU watched helplessly as NATO destroyed Libya makes nonsense of the need to celebrate the UN Day. This one also says, after 8 years, if a president cannot build a house, why waste the taxpayers' money? It came from Ali Wahab in Adu. And then this one also says, it's from Kukwa Kweju Robert, German North. He says, if you break a coconut on a man's head, he will not enjoy it. So insulting the doctors will not solve the problems, but persuasive language will do the trick. And that's it for tonight's edition of Behind the News. This program came to you live from Broadcasting House here in Accra. It is produced by Kingsley Obenchwe, Edmond Tete, Bright Agama, and Christopher Esiedu, Nina Esoa, technical producer. My name is Abraham Asari. Have a good night.